Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, June 10th. July 10th. Traffic calming or blood pressure raising? Do those new speed humps and bumps on our roads really help? Change can be hard. We talk about this on our Longview segment. We take a closer look at the dismantling of a telescope on Mauna Kea, one of the first to be built on the mountain, one of the first to go. We hear the story behind books on the Hawaiian language dialect of Ni'ihau. And we showcase a film honoring Dick Brewer's contributions to the world of surfing, a master shaper and visionary helping top athletes harness the energy of the waves that they love. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We have watched them emerge over the years, more so recently. We're talking about those traffic calming, complaint-triggering measures, whether they be roundabouts or bulb outs or road striping or speed humps. The idea is to slow drivers down and hopefully save lives. Here to talk about that is our contributing editor, Neil Milner. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, did you go over a few of those humps on the way in?
Fewer than usual because I have a way of driving now, not just to avoid the
humps. To avoid them.
To avoid Kapi'olani, which I've mentioned a couple of times on this show, is a real crazy place to drive down at certain times of this day. We're a little late to the party here as far as traffic calming, but it's become a big thing. And what I'm going to talk about mainly is something that you can easily access. It's a primer on anything you want to know about traffic calming is in this National Highway Safety Commission primer that's online. It's easy to read. If you want to get into the weeds, they've got some of that in there too. But it's a nice kind of overview since we hear about this stuff a lot. So we're going to talk mainly about speed bumps, or there's also something called speed humps. They're close enough, okay. So we can lump it all under speed bumps. Because that seems to raise the visibility here, that's the thing that shows up the most and raises the most kind of commenting. So what I want to do is just briefly say what traffic calming is and then talk about what we know about the effectiveness of these bumps and then talk about why they're controversial. Okay, well, so the first thing, traffic calming is basically a series of different things that you can do to interrupt people's brain when they're driving so that they have to slow down. I mean, it's uncomfortable enough, that you're going to slow down, whether it means lane merging, whether it means islands in the middle, or whatever, or the yellow poles that are on the Pali Highway. The idea is to trigger something that breaks up your process of thinking so that you become more aware of, let's say, pedestrians.
Yeah, it's like, hey, wake up, stop daydreaming,
right.
Pay attention.
And intuitively, those things make a difference. And in fact, they do. If you look at the studies of effectiveness, and the National Highway Safety Commission has sponsored some, and there's some other ones, they certainly do reduce the number of accidents. They reduce the number of fatalities, and they definitely reduce the speed by 10 to 15 miles an hour. So if you get to a speed bump and go over, you're going to slow down. By the way, I should mention, because I forgot, also on the website, you can get a link to Catherine Toth's piece that she did about traffic calming in Hawaii. It's in Civil Beat. You can look on it there. So that's what traffic calming is. That's essentially, they tend to be successful.
I read something that it reduces it by 40%.
Yeah, it depends on what it is. They can be surprisingly hard to study if you really want to get granular, because then you can look at the shape, the size, and some people have tried to do that. But generally, they're seen as being fairly effective. They're also a topic of people's disdain. We'll get back to that in a second. People complain, and the common thing, and this is very common in regard to almost anything. The common thing is my experience is different, you know, and so as far as I'm concerned, going over these bumps, let's say out in Portlock, which is one of the latest in the Kalani-Anioli Highway, doesn't work the way it's supposed to because of this is what happened to me. So that's where it kind of stands. We've done a lot more traffic calming here in the last few years, including lane narrowing, including changing some sidewalks. And you can include in this bike lanes, because bike lanes, not only some of them are protected, but in a sense, that becomes traffic calming because you have to watch out for it. If I were still doing the amount of biking I used to do, I would be cynical about whether they're traffic calming or bike targeting, because because that takes another kind of attentiveness. But part of that is doing that. So they're a public service that's offered to the taxpayer, but they remain quite controversial, or at least controversial enough so that there's a lot of objection.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a recent accident where you had somebody on a, I don't know if it was an electric bike or scooter or something, that hit it at a high rate of speed and was ejected, you know. So you've got, you know, problems.
Sure.
You got to pay attention.
Well, you have to pay attention, but like anything, and that really gets us to the first reason why they're controversial. This is like almost anything else you introduce in life, there are downsides to it. And so one way you deal with negative effects, just as you do with the negative effects, let's say, of a prescription drug or anything else, is to mitigate the negative effects as much as possible. So in this case, if this is what happened, you maybe have better warning. You might lower the speed bump, whatever, although that's not likely. But it would probably be better warning. But there's always somebody who's inconvenienced by these things. And in a totally just, totally unrealistic world, we would all be so community-oriented that they would say, even though I'm inconvenienced, it helps everybody else. Sure, there's some of that, but as the National Highway Safety Commission points out, when you try to implement these things, one of the things you have to do, you have to bring in the stakeholders, the people in the neighborhoods, because people who have them in front of their houses don't like them in front of their houses. And then, so that becomes, you know, I don't like it here, therefore it shouldn't be here. Well, that's politics, right? And there are ways to try to get around that and to build around it. But you always have something here because, in effect, they're made to inconvenience you, right? A speed bump is there to make it inconvenient for you to do something that you would do normally, which is to keep going at the speed, which, let's say, on the Kalani-Anioli Highway is roughly, I don't know, 7 to 10 miles an hour over the limit. This sort of breaks it up. So,
yeah, well, I know the one that's been in the headlines, you know, more recently is the one there by McKinley, right,
where
Sarah Yarrow got hit walking to school at McKinley. And so that was very, very tragic. But that was one of those first ones to emerge.
Sure. Well, I mean, they tend to emerge because of very sad and very visible incidents. That whole set of things on the Poly Highway, which includes speed bumps, those yellow things that rationally you know you can drive between, but you always worry, and so you slow down. A lot of that is because we were setting records for the number of elderly pedestrians that were getting killed there. It's a very hard street to cross because you, even with a light, with timed lights, it's six lanes, and you have to really clip along. And if you're not aware, if it's not clearly marked, then you've got another thing against it.
And you've got other cities where they've looked at this kind of thing. And
well, that's another thing that makes, yeah, the other cities have done it. Cities vary. Also, these are worldwide phenomena. But another reason that it can be more controversial in some places than others is some cities have a longer history and, let's say, a longer traffic calming culture than others. The one that's way far in the direction of having a history and a lot of traffic calming is Portland, Oregon, where I've driven a lot. And they have an enormous, you can come to a corner where there's a special stoplight for bikes. there's a bike lane, there's other kinds of things, there's blinking lights. In Hawaii, it's still fairly new. Mm-hmm. When I moved here in the 70s, you couldn't, there were almost no bike lanes, and the one that existed on University Avenue, I thought it was a joke when I first arrived, because it seemed like making you a target.
Yeah, well, lots of opinions about these traffic calming devices, and folks can read about it in this report. But thanks so much, Neil.
Sure. Take care. Drive safely.
Yes. We've been talking to our contributing editor, Neil Milner, on the Long View. We'll have a link to that report that he mentioned on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
The Board of the Mauna Kea Stewardship Oversight Authority meets tomorrow. It has a new executive director, John DeVries, and will add a familiar face, Neil Hannes, to its board. It'll get an update on the legal challenge filed by the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And while the work for the future of the mountain gets underway, we thought we'd take a closer look at the recent removal of the Caltech Submillimeter Observatory, or CSO. And although it was the first to begin the decommissioning process, it technically wasn't the first to go down. The University of Hawaii at Hilo Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship says the removal of the Hokukea Observatory was finished a month earlier. Still, the decommissioning of the long-shuttered observatory was a significant milestone in the plan for the mountain. The conversation's Russell Subiono spoke with Gregory Chun and Nahua Gillows, both with the Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship.
So it's a very involved process, and each step along the way, there are multiple reviews, both internally at UH as well as through the Center of Mauna Kea Stewardship's advisory committees. We have various advisory committees that all review these projects. So that by itself took a while. But once we got all of that in place, they were able to start work. They got a little bit late start last year, so they ran into some winter weather. So they had to pause after they had removed the telescope itself and done some of the interior demolition. And then they restarted this spring again. You know, it was an involved process. It's the first time we at CMS have done a project this large for a while on the mountain. And so it was a learning experience for all of us. And, you know, a lot of what we learned was the importance and the degree of on-site, on-the-ground project coordination, because you had multiple contractors, multiple moving parts and whatnot. And all of this is occurring in the context of our other management responsibilities, which also include ensuring safe access for the public to the summit, ensuring safe access for the observatory staff. So, you know, coordinating traffic was a very, very involved daily endeavor. There's a lot of other details that we could get into, but from my perspective, just the day-to-day project management was probably the most challenging part of the whole process.
I agree with Greg. I think the on-site project management was our biggest challenge, and then coordinating every single day. I mean, we've still got operations happening on the mountain, observatories going to work, you know, people coming and visiting. So in addition to coordinating all of the construction movements, we still had to keep in mind that we didn't want to cause any delays to our visitors or our other observatories that use the mountain as well.
We're actually having project closeout meeting with the contractors and with Caltech. So one of the things I've asked them to prepare is a list of lessons learned. And so I don't know sort of all of the details yet, but it does appear that there are aspects of our management plan that will probably need to be revised and updated because of some things that we learned in this process. Different kind of permits that come into play when you require, you know, a Department of Health review and stuff like that.
I imagine a lot of people are wondering where all the parts and the debris from the observatory ended up. I know that the mirror, I remember, was transported for use at another observatory. I feel like you guys made it a purpose to make sure that everything was removed and taken someplace. Where did all that stuff end up at?
So the mirror actually went to Chile. It's being recycled and being reused at a site in Chile. So that was the interior telescope. The hazardous materials on the inside, they were all properly disposed of with a hazardous materials contractor supervising all of that part of the work. And that was all taken and properly disposed at the landfill. And then the exterior metal structure, it was as well cut up into pieces. Northwest Demolition did a really nice job of bringing up a big scissors. And it's just one of these big excavators with a nice scissors on the front and cut it up in pieces so that it could come down easily without any safety issues to people. And all of that metal was taken down off of the mountain as well. Then the concrete foundation was all dug up and as well taken to the local landfill and properly disposed of. A lot of the metal that could be recycled was recycled as well. So they did a lot of sorting where you wouldn't normally, you know, in a normal construction, some places they just bring in a dozer, make a big pile and then take it to the landfill. Caltech actually took extra care in making sure to sort out all of the recyclable metals that could be recycled. There's a lot of recycling that went on in this project, and the things that couldn't be recycled actually went to the landfill.
You know, everything on Mauna Kea is very sensitive. What kind of involvement did cultural advisors or the community have in the process or as the process wrapped up?
So from a cultural advisory perspective, we have a cultural advisory group called Kahukuman. So they were part of the internal review of all of the plans and permits, and their input was actually incorporated into the best management practices or different aspects of the decommissioning plan. Nahua, maybe you can speak to what happened on site with the monitors.
CSO, like all of our construction contracts that happened on the Mauna, had a cultural monitor on site. And that's to make sure, you know, anything relating to culture is taken care of and properly addressed. And they were there every single day. TaylorMade Productions, they're the ones that took care of all of the cultural monitoring. And then we also had an archaeological monitor on site as well. So both were there. We have a lot of cultural sites that are in the proximity. Oleahu, Puvekyu, and some of those things are very close by. And so we wanted to be very mindful. And then Lake Waiau is below. And we just wanted to make sure that everything was very, very carefully considered, you know, and culture was very prominent and foremost in our minds to make sure we did a right job.
If anybody questions how expensive it was to remove the observatory, I think you can point to the fact that everybody wanted to do it the right way, and people's time and specialty costs money for them to be there to ensure that everything is being done the right way.
Another thing, Russell, that not necessarily cultural piece, but these monitors all work together. I mean, Caltech was required under our requirements to have an independent construction monitor. So it's not the project manager for them. It's just an independent construction monitor to make sure that the workers were following the plan. And that person had the authority to stop work at any time. In addition to that, we had our own, CMS had our own construction monitor. And that person worked closely, well, the two construction monitors worked closely with the archaeological and cultural monitors. And our construction monitor also had the authority to stop work at any time. And there were a couple times that they did it.
Can you say why it stopped?
It would stop if it was too windy. And say they were doing some hazardous materials removal. They were doing some, you know, taking out some sheetrock that may have had some lead paint on it. The cultural monitor actually stopped the job because he didn't want any particles of the sheetrock to go in the air and possibly, you know, end up on Pu'upoleahu or somewhere in the land around. And so something like that, as simple as you think it is, you know, here down at sea level, we don't think about those things. But when you're working on a very culturally sensitive place, those are the kinds of things where they stopped the job. The wind was too high, you know, and said, hey, let's reconvene tomorrow. We'll take a look at how the weather is and make sure it's safe, not only for the people, but for the surrounding landscape.
I've read that the site where the CSO was located has been restored. Can you talk about the restoration process and kind of describe what the site looks like now?
We tried to renaturalize it as close as possible to what we thought it might have looked like. I don't know how to describe it. You got to be there.
Yeah.
I guess the challenge we had was there was not many photographs taken of the site before CSO was built. You know, they were there in the 60s and there wasn't a lot of photographs back then of landscape, you know, that people did. So we did extensively look for photographs, but we couldn't find any. So the next thing they had was had these geotech engineers come out and take a look at the surrounding landscape and try to, I guess you would say, you know, forecast or hypothesize of what it would look like. And then, so the construction company had some guidelines of how they were going to cut the soil and take the site down. But then, you know, we looked at it and then it just came down to what I call you just look at the site and then you go, okay, I think we've taken enough. Goodfellow Construction did a great job. They had a couple of heavy equipment operators that worked in landscaping. And those guys with that excavator basically used the excavator, sifted out the soil and placed each rock to make it match and just meticulously went through it. They dug everything up to soften the soil, brought up the rocks, and then placed them. So they did use some scientific, and then it came out down to a little bit of finesse, you know, to really make it look. And then at the end, the cultural monitor, the construction monitor, our monitor looked at it, talked about it with the contractor and said, hey, you know, it doesn't look good here. It doesn't look there. Can we change this a little bit? Can we stick a rock up here? So it was a collaborative effort. It wasn't so scientific. There was a lot of collaboration in getting the site to be renaturalized to what you can see today. And it was challenging. It wasn't easy, but we had some great partners to work with.
In your guys' opinion, does it look like there was ever a structure there?
It's hard to tell. If you didn't know, you probably couldn't tell. The guys worked really hard. They said with a couple of rains, no one will be able to tell. You know, you can see that the excavator kind of scratched around and looked, but right now, the color, they even tried to match the color. We have a batch plant where we have soil that's set aside from other locations on the Mauna. They took some of that soil to help match, to blend, you know, the soil. So these guys did a really good job of working hard to get it to blend. It's really hard to tell that there was anything there.
Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners about the future of the CSO site or other observatories that may be decommissioned on Mauna Kea in the future? Is there anything that you just kind of want to leave with our listeners?
Well, in the case of both Hokukea and CSO, we had agreed from the very beginning that both those sites would never be recycled into another observatory site. That option is off the table for both of those locations. In terms of future decommissionings, as you know, the 2023 legislature, the passed Act 255 was established a Mauna Kea Stewardship Oversight Authority that will replace university in 5 years. Part of their kuleana is they're supposed to develop a new management and master plan, which also supposed to articulate what does a future astronomy footprint look like. Under the UH plan that we adopted in 2022, we had reduced the footprint, total footprint, to 9. But that plan now is on pause as an authority develops their plan. So we don't know yet what that will look like.
That was Gregory Chun and Nahua Gillows with the UH Hilo Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiono about completing the decommissioning of the Caltech Submillimeter Observatory. Gillows says approximately 40% of the materials from the removed observatory were recycled. The California Institute of Technology will monitor the site for the next 3 years to document the natural repopulation of plants and wildlife.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point from WBUR. Every day, On Point tries to help make sense of our world. We'll learn together, challenge our thinking, we'll meet some amazing people, and hopefully we'll have some fun too.
beginning this afternoon at 2.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we talk about Internet Access and the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD, challenge process. We'll talk to the city and county of Honolulu to find out how they're helping community members ensure broadband delivery. That's this evening at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, okaholabe, ohawaii.
Today, we honor popular musician and radio show host Webley Edwards. Edwards' career as a journalist gave him the opportunity to witness both the Pearl Harbor attack and the Japanese surrender, the start and the end of World War II for the U.S. He eventually ended up in politics as a state legislator and a state senator during the territorial period in statehood, but he is most well known for his role as host of Hawaii Calls, a popular radio program broadcast live from Waikiki Beach between 1933 and 1975. The program featured authentic Hawaiian music and native performers, but their lyrics were sung in English. Edwards wrote many of these lyrics. In fact, he also wrote the lyrics for a song that accompanied a popular sugar commercial. For today's backyard quiz, we are looking for the name of this song. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NāreitHawaii.com.
Hawaii's only Hawaiian immersion school in the Ni'ihau dialect is on a mission to publish 1,000 books in Olelo Ni'ihau. Students and staff have spent the last 6 years writing and publishing hundreds of books in their native tongue. HPR reporter Ku Vehiraishi joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, each year, every student from preschool through 12th grade at Ke Kula Ni'ihau o Ke Kaha Charter School on Kauai authors at least one book in the Ni'ihau dialect. In Olelo Ni'ihau, and for those who might not have heard it, it's a bit different from the dialect of Hawaiian that you will hear at the University of Hawaii or in other Hawaiian immersion schools. They'll use T's and R's in places of K's and L's, and so it sounds a bit different, different vocabulary, different words, but Ke Kula Ni'ihau o Ke Kaha Charter School is the only, as you mentioned, Hawaiian language immersion school in the Ni'ihau dialect, in the state, and the school's mission is to kind of strengthen and perpetuate the Ni'ihau dialect of Hawaiian among the children and youth of the Ni'ihau community there on Kauai's west side. And to date, students and staff have written and published more than 400 books in the Niihau dialect, and here are some of the young authors talking about their experience.
Reading books is actually really fun because you get to do all these excursions to find out research. You get to go on all these apps and other stuff to find research for it.
You have to write about, will we perpetuate Olelo Niihau or not? And I said to perpetuate.
I like when we read to our parents because we feel like really special to when we make those books.
That's Ava Parangao, Liloa Pantanan, and Brooklyn Keale, all student authors of Ke Kula Niihau o Ke Kaha. 400 books is a lot compared to 6 years ago when the students began writing and publishing books. Po'otumu, or Principal Tia Curdy, had arrived a couple of years before that and realized there were no books on the school's campus in Olelo Niihau.
In 2016, I was a new principal. It was important for me to understand what our community expected of me as the new leader, what they had envisioned for their own children, also what the children had envisioned for themselves. At that time, there were zero materials published in our language. A lot of it was handwritten and or delivered orally. It was important for me to begin the building the foundation of a program. We first established Kealapito, which is our syllabary foundation. And following Kealapito, we were able to now publish resources, so publish books and other curricular resources.
So Curdy actually worked with Hamline University in Minnesota to create these books and really find topics that her students would be interested in. So many of the topics include things that are important for people from Niihau. So, of course, the shell making, lei making, but also things like throw net fishing and working on the aina. And so all of these, every year, they'll come up with I think this past year, it was persuasive writing. And so the students go ahead and pick something from their community, from their family, put it into book form, and then later in the year that's published, and they can use that material in the classroom.
And so I'm just curious, though, why Minnesota?
That is interesting. I'm not sure what that connection is, to be honest, but I do know there are some local publishers who would probably hear this story and think, oh my goodness, I need to reach out, see if we can get them involved with our publishing house. But for Olelo Niihau in particular, we don't hear it enough as part of the conversation about Hawaiian language immersion education at the Capitol. Every now and again, you'll have Olelo Niihau speakers coming in and saying, hey, don't forget about us. It's a little different for our Olelo, and we want to be included and be at the table on it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I have nieces and nephews that have gone through the immersion program, you know, and always wondered, yeah, is there a difference between, you know, the Hawaiian that you learn at Benjamin Parker or right. A Lani? I mean, I don't know.
Yes, no, they've got to be more than just these two dialects. You know, a lot of kind of revitalizing the language was figuring out how to standardize it. And Niihau, at least in a broader sense across all Hawaiian language immersion schools, was not part of that effort, at least not as strongly as you're seeing here at Ke Kula Niihau o Ke Kaha. But now that they have that Kealapito, so that syllabary foundation, they can take that out and teach other communities. And maybe we'll see an Olelo Niihau class coming into a community statewide sometime soon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think of all the online learning that's been going on, it would be nice to hear the difference.
The Duolingos,
right? Yes.
Of the world. We'll see. I'd be interested to see. I know capacity-wise, it's probably a bit limited for the students and staff there, you know, because they've kind of got to figure out what they're going to do for their school. But as more and more speakers come through that education system, I can't imagine where Olelo Niihau is going to be in 5 or 10 years from now.
Yeah, because we have so much more that's being published, scholarly articles, that revitalization. So, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. But thank you so much, Kuvi.
Mahalo.
We have been talking to HPR's Ku'uwe Hirashi. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. For today's Manu Minute, we are dishing up a bird that is often seen but not heard. The Eva, or Great Frigate Bird, flies high above our heads, performing acrobatic feats midair. We've got the song of this storied seabird today, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo's Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
One of the most distinctive birds in the skies above Hawaii is the Eva, or Great Frigate Bird. Dark black and a bit ominous looking, they have a distinctive bent wing silhouette when in flight, with long pointed wings, a long hooked bill, and a deeply forked tail. Eva are found in oceans throughout the tropics, and while they're often seen on all the main Hawaiian islands, they nest primarily in shrubs and small trees in the northwest Hawaiian islands. Eva are incredibly agile flyers, and they use this maneuverability to harass other seabirds in flight and force them to drop their food, which they'll often grab in mid-air. The biological term for this pirate-like behavior is kleptoparasitism, and this has led to their Hawaiian name of Eva, which means thief, though they actually do catch the majority of their food themselves by skimming the ocean surface for fish and squid. Eva have the largest wings for their body weight of any bird in the world, and recent studies using satellite transmitters have shown that they can fly over 2 months without landing. While they're incredible flyers, they lack the ability to take off from water, and they're also very clumsy on land. Eva are one of those birds that are much more often seen than heard. The best place to hear their vocalizations are on their breeding grounds, where the males attempt to attract females by blowing up a brilliant orange balloon-like pouch below their bills and uttering a hoarse cackle when the female comes near. Unlike many other native bird species in Hawaii, the Eva seem to be doing well, with a population size estimated at 60,000 birds or more. Eva have a lifespan of about 35 years, and like many seabirds, wait a long time before they first breed, in their case, 9 years or older. Eva are featured prominently in Hawaiian culture, and their glossy black feathers were used in the kahili of royalty and in feathered capes. One well-known Olelo Noeau proclaims, "Lele ka Eva malie kai ko'o," meaning, when the Eva bird flies out to sea, the rough sea will be calm. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. Since 1939, fostering community values that help to protect Hawaii's native wildlife through educational programs and scientific research. More at hiaudubon.org.
When you support HPR, you support unmatched coverage of culture and the arts.
Weaving in the Philippines goes back to the 13th century. These particular textiles include patterns weaved into fabric that tells a story about an island's region.
Some of them are like about talking about their ancestral lineage, their ancestral knowledge, and some of them are about their dreams.
Thanks to your support, HPR brings you history and context behind the artwork.
For a lot of our people who have fought the atrocities around the Spanish colonization, they have used those leaves as a functional piece for them to hide their knives so they can fight the Spaniards behind their backs when they need to survive.
Support cultural reporting on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Now it's time for us to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we explored a bit about the life of Webley Edwards, a popular radio show host and musician in the 1900s. He wrote the English lyrics for many of the Hawaiian songs featured on his show. However, one of his most popular songs was featured in a 1970s C&H sugar commercial. The song is titled Pearly Shells, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. It uses the melody of an older Hawaiian language song, Pupu A'o Eva, or the shells of Eva. But interestingly, the older song's lyrics aren't about the shells at all. It's about the area of Pu'uloa, or Pearl Harbor, as we know it today, where pearl oysters were discovered. Edwards collaborated with Leon Pober, who wrote the song Tiny Bubbles, to adapt the song for a modern audience. And congrats to our backyard quiz winner, Andrew Johnson from Kalaheo, Kauai. You got it right. That's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Early shell,
from the ocean,
shining in the sun,
covering the shore,
Want to get stoked? Well, if surfers are your peeps, you may want to know about a new film that debuts here in Hawaii about a man who revolutionized the art of surfboard shaping. It's called The Shape of Things, the Dick Brewer story. Here's part of the trailer.
When I look at Dick Brewer's boards, the one thing that always stood out to me was how clean they came out. And when you look at anything in nature, you look at a bird flying through the air, and when they're in their top speed position, they look at this perfect foil.
These are Dick Brewer's stomping grounds, the North Shore of Hawaii. This is where the whole world comes to train to ride the biggest wave.
From beginning to end, he's like just the man. And maybe I would say they broke the mold with Dick Brewer. No, he made the mold.
A little bit like the Mad Professor. You know, you got the Mad Professor, you go see him.
But as he said, he was gifted, very gifted with his hands. I mean, you are an artist.
He was operating in a time when there was no roadmap.
But I also knew him for his other talents, so I looked up to him.
When you look out from shore and you see these waves on the second reef, you realize these waves are lining up. These waves are really good.
We looked at it and went, my God, what are we going to do with that?
We were just tripping out. It was like a really revolutionary time. Music was changing. It was youth against the establishment.
Dick Brewer was my father. He's a very famous surfboard builder. When people would hear that, they would be like, he's like the best, you know, I had this board way back in the day, and you know, it was just magic.
I just think he's the best that ever was.
Suddenly everybody thought, shorter, lighter, faster.
Shorter, lighter, faster. We sat down with Jim Kempton, who helped with the screenplay. The Bob Campy film pays tribute to Brewer. It makes its debut tomorrow night at the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Kempton knows a bit about the sport. We featured him on the show before. He was involved with the film Big Wave Guardians, about big wave surfers at Waimea Bay. Kempton has long been with Surfer and Transworld Surf magazines and currently runs the California Surf Museum.
The story has needed to be told for a long time. Dick Brewer is kind of the Leonardo da Vinci of surfboard design. He changed the world of surfboards and shapes three different times in his lifetime. Once when he did a board specifically for Pipeline, called the Pipeliner. Once when he invented the minigun, the one that actually really worked as far as shortboards and the shortboard revolution goes. And then a third time, many years later, when he designed a board for tow surfing. And his life is, you know, like everyone's, it has its triumphs and its tragedies. And, you know, he was a brilliant guy, but like most people who are really, really bright, they're a little bit out there as well. And also, you know, can have sad and great things both happening to him. So it's a movie that really, I think, people will relate to.
You are over there at the Surf Museum, right in California?
Yes, the California Surf Museum in Oceanside.
And so you come here to Hawaii often, you know, you're plugged into the surf scene over here. What was your experience like with Mr. Brewer?
Well, he was sort of a legendary guy. He was famous almost from the time that most of us started surfing. I mean, we learned on longboards, but basically we all transitioned to shortboards as teenagers. So you can imagine he was the guy that did that. So we'd hold him in high esteem and you were a little intimidated. But as the years went on, and also as I worked for Surfer Magazine and then worked for Trans World Publications. I got to know him, and he mellowed out too. He was an intense guy because he had all these ideas, and anyone who's having new ideas, people are resistant to change. So you have to fight for getting them. And that was part of Dick's genius and also part of his conflict.
For folks, you know, who don't know his life, I mean, he came from Minnesota.
He came from Minnesota, moved to California with the big boom that everyone moved for the aerospace industry and, you know, right after World War II. And he went to Cal State and got an engineering degree, or one unit short of getting an engineering degree, but was, so he was well trained for what he was supposed to do. He had built model airplanes and was like a champion with that. He had raced cars and dragsters. So he knew about how to design things to do what you wanted them to do. And he was obsessed with that. And when he got on a plane and came to Hawaii, he decided that was it. This is where he wanted to be, and that's what he wanted to design. And, you know, one of the interesting things is in automobile and planes, it's aerodynamics. But what Dick saw really early was that hydrodynamics have exactly the same principles. So he began to incorporate that into the design of surfboards and pretty much revolutionize them.
So do you have any Brewer boards?
I do. You know, it's a funny thing. I emceed his memorial out at Waimea Bay, and they had a big paddle out there, and there must have been 200 people. Every single one paddled out on a Brewer. Everybody's kept one, you know.
Nice. So how did you get involved with this film?
You know, I've written a number of screenplays for movies, so most directors are not always sure exactly how they want to lay it out. They need help with structure. Our director is a really talented guy. He's an incredible editor. He's worked for Entertainment Tonight. Bob Campion is his name, and a very, very talented guy. But I think he wanted some help in terms of just structuring the storyline and how to get from A to B and how to make that dramatic. So that's what I helped him with.
I don't know, were there any challenges in putting this film together?
You know, the hardest thing is, believe it or not, there's very little footage of Dick himself. And so that's at a premium, and it was very difficult to sort of find it and get it. But the interviews, of course, everyone knows Dick, so that was actually easier than most biopics are. But getting his footage was the biggest challenge, I think, from that standpoint.
What do you hope people will take away when they see this film?
I think that a lot of people either don't know really him and his story. They only know, you know, the top part of that. And so I think they'll come away with a much richer, deeper understanding of the man and his challenges and his struggle and his triumphs and achievements.
You mentioned that he had some bad things happen.
Yeah, he was in an automobile accident where one of his kids was killed and another one was severely injured. That sent him into a really dark place for a long time. It took him a long time to come back from that. Everyone, no matter what they are, not are always vulnerable to family tragedy.
Yeah, so he had those family tragedies, but then worked through that time and through that loss, but then went on to develop other things.
The funny thing about Dick is that his longevity was part of his success, because there were actually people like Laird Hamilton, whose father, Billy, stepfather Billy, but the man who raised him and who was a great surfer of the 60s, you know, he had championed Brewer's boards when he was one of the top surfers. So Laird knew when he needed to figure out how to make boards that would ride 50-foot waves after they had discovered Jaws, he knew he had to go to Dick Brewer, and he did. So that was sort of Dick's resurrection and redemption song, so to speak.
With your work there at the California Surf Museum, I mean, you know, you've been involved in now a number of films with Hawaii ties, right, because of the sport. What is it that you love when you're out there, you know, on the floor when people come through your museum?
Oh, what I love is that we get to share what is such a special thing. You know, I mean, obviously surfers think that surfing is special, but I have this theory that all things, all energy moves in waves, light waves, sound waves, x-rays. Right now, there are waves going through us we don't even know. But the only place on the planet that you can actually feel that energy of the universe is when you're riding an ocean wave. And that stoke, is what surfers call it, is kind of ineffable. You can't describe it. So sometimes they sound like idiots when they try to do that. But it is something so special that they, you know, they have the expression, only a surfer knows the feeling. And I think when you come to the museum, even if you don't surf and even if you're from Minnesota yourself or from Ireland, we have people coming from 50 countries and all 50 states, they get a little picture of that. They can feel it. They can feel what it is, and they get a sense of that history and that lineage, which is a very unique one. Most sports don't have the kind of historical heritage that surfing does. We really, really respect our elders, and everybody knows the people that came before them and pay homage to them. And that's really what this Dick Brewer piece is about as well, is paying homage to someone who revolutionized the world. All these kids would not be surfing on short boards if it hadn't been for Dick inventing it, so to speak, or at least inventing the ones that worked.
People will get a chance to see this film.
It's premiering here at the Doris Duke Theater on Thursday at 6 o'clock, and it has never been seen before by the public.
Wow. Okay, so are you going to take it on a film circuit?
We plan on that. We've actually got a number of film festivals already lined up.
What should people know if they want to catch the film this weekend?
Well, it's sold out for this weekend, unfortunately, but they can buy, I would say, buy tickets early for the 20th because it's sold out in about 5 minutes. And, you know, everyone who has ever known Dick Brewer wants to see the movie. And that's thousands of people. So if you have an interest in it, get tickets early. I'm sure they'll be playing it. I'm sure we'll be back, too, in the theaters here.
Anything else that you want to share just about his life and about the film that you think is compelling?
Well, it's interesting because when you really get down to people, it's oftentimes not the surfers themselves that are the most interesting subjects. It's the people behind the scenes, whether that be, you know, John Severson, who started Surfer, or Hobie Alter, who made boards as well, or Bruce Brown, who made The End of the Summer, or Dick Brewer, who revolutionized shaping. Those people tend to be the people who are oftentimes the most interesting subjects. And surfers are like all other great athletes. They break a lot of records, but they may not have the overall interest to the general public that people like Dick does.
That was Jim Kempton talking to us about a new film entitled The Shape of Things, The Dick Brewer Story. It'll be part of the Surf Film Festival at the Honolulu Museum of Art. The first screening tomorrow night is already sold out, but it will run again next weekend on Saturday, July 20th. We'll have a link on the conversation page of our website after the show.
For the sand and the sea, the only love for me, I'm a surfing. Yeah, I'm surfing.
Well, we're out of time now, but up tomorrow we plan to sit down with Sam Shoemaker, the new dean of the University of Hawaii's Medical School. Shoemaker is a familiar face and returns home to his alma mater to give back. Got a story you would like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Google, Spotify, and Apple, and on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.